You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and Rudolf Steiner Press in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner to English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 99, by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Rosicrucian Wisdom, 14 Lectures, translated by Johanna Kallas. This is Lecture 7, given in Munich on the 31st of May, 1907, entitled The Technique of Karma. To help you understand how the law of karma works in human life, I shall speak of something that happens immediately after the death of a human being. We heard of the memory tableau that appears when he is freed from his physical body and lives for a short time in the ether and astral bodies before passing through the elemental world. To show you the inner working of karma, let me describe a strange feeling that arises during the experience of this great tableau. It is a feeling of expansion, of growing beyond oneself. This feeling becomes stronger and stronger as long as we are still living in our ether body. We have a strange experience in connection with this tableau. First of all, we see pictures of our past life in a panorama. Then, a moment comes, not very long after death, and lasting for hours, even days, according to the nature of the individual, when we feel, I myself am all these pictures. We feel our ether body growing and expanding, as if it embraced the whole surrounding sphere of the earth as far as the sun. Then, when the ether body has been abandoned, another very remarkable feeling arises, one that is really difficult to describe in words drawn from the physical world. It is a feeling of expansion into wide cosmic space, but as though one did not actually fill out every place in it. The experience can only be approximately described. The individual feels as though with one part of his being he were in Munich, with another part in Mainz, a third in Basel, and another far outside the earth sphere, perhaps on the moon. He feels as though he were dismembered, as though he were not connected with the spaces in between. This is the specific way in which one experiences oneself as an astral being, spread out in space, transferred to different centers, but not filling the regions between them. This experience lasts throughout the Kamaloka period, during which we live through our life backward to birth. We live through all that belongs to us, and these experiences then become part of the rest of life in Kamaloka. It is important to know this in order to picture how the law of karma works. The individual feels at the beginning as though he were within that human being with whom he was last connected, and then retrogressively within all the persons and other beings with whom he was associated during his life. Suppose, for example, you once thrashed someone in Mainz. After your death, when the time comes, you experience the thrashing you gave with its accompanying pain. If that person is still in Mainz, a part of your astral body, after your death feels itself in Mainz, experiencing the event there. If the person you thrashed has died in the meantime, you feel yourself at the place in Kamaloka where he now is. You have, of course, been connected not only with one, but with many human beings who are scattered over the earth and in Kamaloka. You are everywhere, and this gives rise to the feeling of dismemberment of the bodily nature in Kamaloka. It is thereby possible for you to experience in all the others the associations you had with them, and you thus form a lasting connection with everyone with whom you have come into contact. You have a tie with this individual whom you thrashed, because you have lived with him in Kamaloka. Later on, you pass into Devakan, and then, in turn, back through Kamaloka. During the process of building a new body, your astral body once again finds the ties which bind it to the person with whom you were united. And, since there are many such connections, you find that you are linked by a kind of bond with everything with which you are associated. The event observed by spiritual sight, of which I told you in the last lecture, offers a clear explanation here. 5 Vaimic judges in the Middle Ages condemned a man to death and executed the sentence themselves. In his previous life, this man had been a kind of chief and had ordered the death of the 5. Then the chief had died and passed into Kamaloka. During this period, he was transported to the places where they now were, entering right into them and experiencing what they had felt when they had been put to death. This is the starting point of forces of attraction which bring human beings together when they return to the earth, in order that the law of karma may be fulfilled. Such is the technique of karma, the way in which karma works. You see from this that there are forms of existence, kindred ties, which begin already on the astral plane. On the physical plane there is continuity of substance. On the astral plane, however, related yet separated parts of the bodily nature may be experienced. It is as if you were to feel your head, then nothing at all between head and heart, then the feet, with nothing between heart and feet. One part of you may be in America, quite separated from, but yet belonging to your astral being. Another part may be on the moon, and a third on yet another planet. There need be no visible astral connection between these parts of your being. This view of the law of karma makes it clear that what arises in one human life cycle is the outcome of many causes which lie in past lives. But how is the law of karma to be reconciled with heredity? It is said that there are many contradictions between heredity and this law. People are apt to say of a morally sound person that he must be the offspring of a similarly sound family, that he must have inherited this from his forebears. When we observe the physical processes from the spiritual standpoint, we know that it is not like this. We can, however, in a certain sense, speak of processes of physical heredity, and we will take an example. Within a period of 250 years, 29 musicians were born in the Bach family, among them the great Bach himself. A good musician needs not only the inner musical faculty, but also a well-formed physical ear, a special form of ear. A lay person cannot perceive the differences here. It is necessary to look very deeply with spiritual sight. Although the differences are very slight, a particular inner form of the organ of hearing is necessary if an individual is to become a musician, and these forms are transmitted by heredity. They resemble those that have been present in the parents, grandparents, and so on. Suppose that on the astral plane there is an individual who acquired great musical faculties hundreds or thousands of years ago. He is ready for reincarnation and is seeking a physical body. If he cannot find a physical body possessing suitable ears, he cannot become a musician. He must look around for a family that will provide the musical ear. Without it, his musical talents could not manifest. For the greatest virtuoso can do nothing without an appropriate instrument. Mathematical talent also needs something quite specific. A particular construction of the brain is not, as many people think, necessary for mathematicians. Thinking, logic, is the same in the mathematician as in others. What is needed here is a special development of the 3 semicircular canals in the ears, which lie in the 3 directions of space. Special development of these canals determines mathematical talent. Herein lies the gift for mathematics. This is a physical organ, and its form must be transmitted by heredity. You will remember that 8 first-class mathematicians were born in the Bernoulli family. A person of high moral principles also needs parents who transmit a physical body suitable for the functioning of those moral gifts. So he has these parents and no others, because he is this particular kind of individual. The individuality seeks the parents, though under the guidance of higher beings. From the point of view of maternal love, people take exception to this fact. They are fearful that they might lose something if the child were not to inherit certain qualities from the mother. True knowledge, however, shows maternal love to be something even more profound. It shows that this love is present before birth, even before conception, as a force which guided the child to the mother. The child loves the mother even before birth, and maternal love is the reciprocal force. Spiritually regarded, therefore, maternal love extends to the time before birth. It is rooted in mutual feelings of love. It is often imagined that the human being is subject to an irrevocable law of karma, in which nothing can be changed. Let us take a simile from everyday life to explain the working of this law. A business person enters debits and credits in his account books. Taken together, these entries tell him the current state of his business. The financial state of his business is subject to the inexorable law governing the calculation of debit and credit. If he carries out any new transactions, he can make additional entries, and he would be a fool if he were unwilling to embark on further business once a balance had been drawn up. In respect of karma, everything good, intelligent, and true that has been done by a person belongs on the credit side. Evil or foolish deeds belong on the debit side. At every moment, the individual is free to make new entries in the karmic book of life. It must never be imagined that life is under the sway of an immutable law of destiny. Freedom is not impaired by the law of karma. In studying the law of karma, therefore, the future must be borne in mind as strongly as the past. Bearing within us the effects of past deeds, we are the slaves of the past, but the masters of the future. If we are to have a favorable future, we must make as many good entries as possible in the book of life. It is a great and potent thought to know that nothing we do is in vain, that everything has its effect in the future. The law of karma is the reverse of depressing. It fills us with splendid hope, and knowledge of it is the most precious gift of spiritual science. It brings happiness inasmuch as it opens out a vista into the future. It charges us to be active for its sake. There is nothing whatever in it to make us sad, nothing which could give the world a pessimistic coloring. It lends wings to our will to cooperate in the evolution of the earth. Such are the feelings into which knowledge of the law of karma must be transmuted. When a person is suffering, people sometimes say, quote, he deserves his suffering and must bear his karma. If I help him, I am interfering with his karma. Close quote. This is nonsense. His poverty, his misery is caused through his earlier life. But if I help him, new entries will be made in his book of life. My help takes him forward. It would be foolish to say to a business person who could be saved from disaster by 1,000 or 10,000 marks, quote, no, for that would alter your balance sheet, close quote. It is precisely this possibility of altering the balance sheet that should induce us to help someone. I help him because I know that nothing is without its karmic effect. This knowledge should spur us on to purposeful action. Many people dispute the law of karma from the standpoint of Christianity, with theologians maintaining that Christianity cannot acknowledge this law because it is irreconcilable with the principle of Christ having died on the cross for the sake of all humanity. on the other hand. There are theosophists who say that the law of karma contradicts the principle of the redemption, and that they cannot acknowledge the help given to the many by an individual. Both are wrong, for neither has understood the law of karma. Suppose someone is in distress while you yourself are in a more fortunate position and can help him. By your help, you make a new entry in his book of life. A more influential person can help too and affect the karma of both of them. Someone still more powerful can help 10 or 100 people, and the most mighty of all can help unnumbered human beings. This does not in any way run counter to the principle of karmic connections. Precisely because of the absolute reliability of the law of karma, we know that this help does indeed influence the destiny of the human being. Humanity as a whole was very much in need of help when the Christ individuality was sent to the earth. The Redeemer's death on the cross, the death of one central being, was the help that intervened in the karma of untold numbers of human beings. There is no variance between Christian esotericism and spiritual science when both are rightly understood. There is profound agreement between the laws of both, and we are by no means obliged to abandon the principle of redemption. We penetrate still more deeply into the law of karma when we study the evolution of humanity as a whole, as well as the evolution of the earth. We have considered certain facts which help us to understand the law of karma, and we shall understand other facts still better when we pass on to the evolution of humanity itself, not only during the present Earth period, but also during the other planetary incarnations of the Earth. We shall discover certain supplementary details of this law when we go back to ages in the remote past and receive indications, too, about the far future. By way of introduction, we will consider a fact of great significance. We realized from what has been said that the external physical body, the part of the human being that we see with physical eyes, is built up by the higher members of his being, ego, astral body, ether body, and all the members up to Atma, the highest of them, work at the physical body. The various parts of our makeup as they exist in us today are not of equal but of different value in our nature. Even superficial consideration will make us realize that the physical body is the most perfect part of our nature. Take, for example, a part of the thigh bone. This is not simply a compact, solid bone, but a framework skillfully constructed out of intersecting beams. Anyone who studies this bone, not only with the intellect but also with feeling, will marvel at the wisdom which in its creation has used no more material than is essential to support the upper body with the smallest possible amount of strength. No engineering skill applied to the building of a bridge is equal to the wisdom that has brought such a bone into existence in nature. If we investigate the human heart, but not merely with the eye of the anatomist or physiologist, we shall find in it an expression of sublime wisdom. Do not imagine that the human astral body today is as far advanced in development as the physical heart. The heart has been built up with skill and wisdom. The astral body, with its desires, induces the human being to consume all kinds of heart poisons for many decades. Yet the heart withstands this for many decades. Only in a future stage of evolution will the astral body have reached the stage of development of the physical body today, and then it will be at a far, far higher level than the physical body. Today, the physical body is the most perfect, the ether body is less perfect, the astral body even less perfect, while the ego is the baby among the bodies. The physical body, as it is today, is the oldest member of the human being. Work has been performed on it from the longest period of time, and not until it had reached a certain stage in the course of evolution did it become filled by the ether body. After these two bodies had worked together for a time, the astral body was added, and finally, the I, the ego, which in the future will attain undreamt-of heights of development. Just as the human being has repeated incarnations, so too has our Earth passed through incarnations, and will pass through still others in the future. Reincarnation is enacted throughout the cosmos. Our Earth in its present form is the reincarnation of earlier planetary bodies, of which there have been three. Before our Earth became Earth, it was what is called by esotericism, not by astronomy, moon. The present moon is in a way a body of dross, which was discarded as useless. If we could mingle the Earth and the moon together with all their substances and all their beings, we should have the, quote, occult moon, close quote, the forerunner of Earth. The Earth of today is the remnant of old moon that remained after the dross had been thrown off. Just as the moon of today is a discarded remnant of the old moon incarnation of Earth, so is the sun in the heavens, a body that proceeded from a still earlier incarnation of Earth. Before Earth was moon, it was, as we say in esotericism, sun. And that sun was composed of all the substances and beings which today form the sun, moon, and earth. That sun released itself from the substances and beings which form the earth and moon of today, which it could not, as a higher celestial body, retain. And it thereby became a fixed star. Spiritual researchers know that a fixed star need not always have been a fixed star. The sun only became a fixed star after having been a planet. The sun we see today was once united with the earth and took with it many beings who were at a higher stage of development than the beings of the earth. Just as the moon that we see took away the inferior portions, so that the moon is a body of discarded dross, the moon is a planet that has degenerated. The sun is a body that has ascended. The sun existence was preceded by the Saturn existence. Thus, there are four consecutive incarnations of Earth: Saturn, Sun, Moon, Earth. When the forerunner of the human being was developing on Saturn, his only principle was that of the physical body. The ether body was added on Sun, the astral body on Moon, and the I, or ego, on Earth. The lecture entitled The Occult Significance of Blood will have shown you how intimately the I, capital, is connected with the blood. This blood was not within the human body before the embodiment of an ego, so that this red human blood is connected with the evolution of Earth as such. It could not have been formed at all if Earth, in its evolutionary course, had not come together with another planet, namely with Mars. Before this contact of Earth with Mars, Earth had no iron. There was no iron in the blood. The blood upon which the human being is dependent today did not exist. In the first half of Earth evolution, the influence of the planet Mars is the ruling factor, while the influence of the planet Mercury rules in the second half. Mars has given iron to the Earth, and the Mercury influence manifests on the Earth in such a way that it makes the human soul more and more free, more and more independent. In esotericism, therefore, we speak of the Mars half of Earth evolution and of the Mercury half. Whereas the other names describe a whole planet, Earth evolution is spoken of as, in quotes, Mars-Mercury. Used in this connection, the names do not designate the planets we know today, but the influences at work during the first and second halves of Earth evolution. In the future, Earth will incarnate as a new planetary body known as Jupiter. The human astral body then will have developed to a stage where it no longer confronts the physical body as an enemy, as is the case today. But it will still not have reached its highest stage. The ether body on Jupiter will have reached the stage at which the physical body is now. For it will then have three planetary evolutions behind it, as the physical body has today. On the planetary body following Jupiter, the astral body will have developed as far as the physical body of today. It will have behind it the Moon, Earth, and Jupiter evolutions, and will have reached the Venus evolution. The final planetary incarnation will be that of Vulcan, where the I, the ego, will have attained the highest stage of its development. The future incarnations of Earth will thus be Jupiter, Venus, Vulcan. These designations are also found in the names of the days of the week. There was a time when the names of the things and facts around us in our lives were given by the initiates. People have no inner sense today of the way in which names really belong to things. The names given to the days of the week were meant to be reminders to human beings of their development through the evolutionary stages of Earth. Saturday is Saturn Day. Sunday is Sun Day. Monday is Moon Day. Then Mars and Mercury, the two conditions of our Earth. Tuesday is Mardi in French, or Martedì in Italian. Wednesday is Mercredi in French and Mercoledì in Italian. Votan is the same as Mercury. Tacitus spoke of Votan's day, which is the English Wednesday. Then comes the Jupiter day in French. It is Giovedì, and in Italian Giovedì. Jupiter has affinities with Thor, hence Thursday in English. Venus day is Vendredi in French and Venerdì in Italian. Venus is the Germanic Freier, hence Friday in English, Freitag in German. Thus, in the names of the sequence of days in the week, we have reminders of the development of Earth through its different incarnations. The end of Lecture 7.